Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at in the U.S. or around the world. Welcome to BaseballOutsideTheBox.com. Remember, this is the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. And I just gave you the website, BaseballOutsideTheBox.com. That is where the audio is going to be. But we are also live on Facebook. We'll be live on YouTube and all over social media. Thanks for joining us, folks. We really appreciate it. It is a Tuesday afternoon in chilly Chicago with 20 inches of snow outside, but we had fun shoveling because that is one way to exercise. You just got to be careful. You got to stretch before you do it. Hey, folks, just so you know, when you go to the audio part at baseballoutsidethebox.com, do us a favor, subscribe. Also, go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, subscribe there. That helps us get the show out. We'd really appreciate it if you ask baseball coaches, players, and parents everywhere in your systems to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You, again, Peter Caliendo, go there and subscribe. And bear with us. I've been putting up some of the shows because the Lineup Media Group has had some people on furlough. Everybody's been affected by the pandemic. They're a great organization. They got so many podcasts there. Check them out at lineupmediagroup.com. Check out all the shows, but I have been putting the shows up and I think I've been doing it right. So hopefully you've been enjoying the shows today. Incredible. I say it all the time and this is an incredible show. You all know I've talked about it. I've been to Cuba 9 times, great people, great baseball. We don't even know half of what goes on in Cuba when it comes to baseball. They've been playing it a long time. It's amazing. Some of the things that I found out while I was there, traveling the country, working with coaches. Of course I've got, after being there 9 years, 9 times, got a lot of friends in Cuba, in Cuban baseball. I love it. And we have an exciting show. And I'll tell you why, because a lot of times we look at major league players who come over who have struggled and really had a tough time coming over, been taken advantage of. That's why we need to have a relationship with Cuban baseball, with our governments, because that way people can come over and not get taken advantage of as a player, and you've seen it with Puig and Chapman, a lot of people, they take advantage of these young people because they don't know any better. So let's hope that we correct that. But here's a great story. And folks, when you hear this story, this is the story that needs a book. This is a story that, MLB Network, other people need to pick up. And I'll tell you why, because it's the struggles of Cuba, but we're going to talk to Ernesto Raya. Now, Ernesto goes by Raya, so you're going to hear him call me Raya. He came over when he was 26 years old in the summer of 94. And that was when they allowed the Cubans come over to the U.S. for about a month. But first, you didn't just come to the U.S. You went to Guantanamo Bay. Yes, you heard me say right, Guantanamo Bay. He spent 14 months there, left his family and everything. He's going to tell us the story. We're going to talk about Cuban baseball, but we're also going to talk about what he does here in the States. Right now, he is Matilla Valley High School here in Chicago, where I'm at. And it's amazing. I've been here. I lived there all my life. And I didn't know Ernesto was even here till Mike Cuff, a good friend of ours, made the introduction. And also Raya listens to the show, and I love that. So let's not waste any time here, because we can get into other things with Ernesto, what he does in baseball here in the U.S. But it's going to be exciting. Let me welcome Mr. Raya. ¿Cómo está, amigo? Mucho gusto, amigo. Show.
Muy bien. Mucho gusto, Peter. Muchas gracias. Thank you very much for having me in your show and for spreading baseball around the world. I really appreciate it. I hope that, a lot of people are listening today, because you offer so many opportunities for everybody to learn about the game for free, right in the comfort of your house. It's an incredible opportunity for those people that really love baseball to learn more and more about, from coaches, even Major League Baseball. You interview people from all over the world, Japan, Italy, and every part of the world, baseball is different. And even though it's the same game, it's that in a different way. And we learn from each other. So sometimes we are assuming in our country, we play the best baseball, in the world, but because we don't know how the people play in some other parts of the world. But you have the opportunity to travel a little bit, and then you got that knowledge and you spread it out with everybody that wants to listen to you. And I really appreciate that, because I have learned so much from your show than just from the chair of my house, not even getting out of the door in this cold weather.
Gracias, amigo. And I'm going to say this. Estoy practicando mi español. Ogni día Estoy practicando. So hopefully I'm practicing my Spanish, everybody. That's what I've just mentioned. It's the little words I know. You know, and you talk about, here's where I want to really get into, because, you know, you and I talked for a couple hours offline, you know, about a week ago, week and a half ago. And, you know, I just had a lot of questions, even though I've been to Cuba 9 times. But I want to go back into your childhood a little bit. And for folks who are just joining us, the episode prior to this, you know, Raya mentioned, you know, all over the world, we just had the New Zealand CEO, New Zealand baseball, another area where, you know, not many players, but man, do they got some athletes playing college baseball, professional baseball. They can even come and play high school baseball. So that's an up and coming country. So he's right. There's so many places we're not even aware of that have great baseball. Hey, Raya, tell us about growing up in Cuba. You know, when you're baseball wise, you know, when you started playing and what was it like? What were the coaches like back then? Because I know it was a long time ago, but it'd be interesting to hear what you did when you were a young kid.
Growing up in Cuba, your parents, the first thing to do is take you to the baseball field. Okay. When you are 3 or 4 years old. But in my case, it wasn't my dad that took me to the baseball field. It was my mom. Mm. My dad never touched a baseball. My dad never played a baseball. He was a mechanic. But my mom, I remember, took me to the dream field because it was just red dirt and plain field. There was nothing out there. It was just to organize the game and start playing the game because that's where we can only pick up games. So I remember my mom, I was 6, and my mom said, okay, I'm going to hit the ball and you're going to run to that base. That's called first base. And then from there, you go to second base, the next base over there. And she taught me how to play the game. And I got an association with the game and my mom. So that's why I fall in love with the game. And for me, baseball and my mom go together. That's how much I love the game. She played pickup games until she was 70 years old. Wow. Even here, she lives in Florida right now. She's 82. She's still watching every single game that she can. She loves baseball. But in Cuba, for her, especially in the 50s, okay, a woman playing baseball wasn't something typical.
No.
You know, only men, we play sports. So we're talking about the 40s and the 50s. So it's a different society, different times. But she didn't mind to go and play baseball. So she would play pickup games on the weekend with me and my cousins. So she was fine. Even here in the States, when in Florida, one day she went with her grandson on Sunday to play a pickup game. And she was 70 years old. And the friend were questioning, what your grandma is doing here? And she say, my nephew say, she gonna play? She says, you joking, right? He said, no, she played baseball. So that's how much she loved the game. She even started playing a pickup game here at the age of 70. She didn't mind. She didn't mind. She loved the game. So now she watches every single game that she can on TV. But well, answering your question, growing up in Cuba, We eat baseball all day long. Like on Saturdays and Sunday, I would go to play pickup games. And then I will go in the morning, 8 in the morning, I would be with my friends playing a game. My mom will have to come and get me out of the field by 8 o'clock at night because that's all what we want to do, play games. Also, there was, some adversity. Because we don't have baseballs, we don't have equipment, so we had to make them by ourselves. So we made baseball out of cloth. We played with a broomstick and a cork. So it helped us. It helped us because without knowing, you know, you are working in your tempo, you are working in your eye-hands coordination, the same when you're playing over the gravels and the ball bounced so much unexpected in the last minute and you got to react to it. So those are things that we were exposed to it without us knowing and what made us, you know, great defensive player or great hitters, you know. And today, when you look in Latin America, I mean, are the same condition for many countries, you know, Colombia, Dominican Republic. You go to this island and you're going to find the same conditions. Not everybody going to have a baseball field where they could play baseball. Not everybody going to have the equipment to play baseball. Like you say, you know, in your interview to Jan from New Zealand, he was talking about how difficult it is to have the equipment and the beginning to develop the game in that country, right? And right now, they got like 20 professional teams in a league. So that's awesome.
What do you think, you know, recently when I was in Cuba, you know, I met with the Federation. We were talking. Federation folks is the governing body of the sport in Cuba that runs all of baseball, very well organized. And they mentioned to me, you know, one of the things they were struggling with was getting kids to play the game because a lot of kids want to go to soccer, even in Cuba. You know, when you grew up, everybody played in Cuba. All the kids play baseball. What do you think makes Cuban players very good at baseball? Because you mentioned adversity, lack of equipment, you know, that makes them better because they have to figure it out. But what are there anything else for our audience that, you know, makes the Cuban players very good that can come over here and play in the U.S.?
Well, it's the competition because you only have 18 spots in the team to make the team and represent your town. They're going to be 60, 70 people in the tryouts, but only 18 made this the team. So the quality of the play is concentrated. So, you know, you are playing, you are representing your city. Okay, that's something that is important too, because for example, if you compare Cuba with the US, this summer, you are in a little league and you represented your team is called San Francisco. Next summer, your team is called White Sox, right? Yeah. But when you are playing in Cuba, the letters that you got in your chest, the letters of the name of your town. So it's something that you take pride on it. When you look at that and you look at the Olympic Games, right? The quality that you see in the Olympic Games, okay? And all the sports, right? And the pride of the athletes, it is about representing the country, the flag, you know, and they take pride in that. And then growing up, that's the way we were, you know. Our town, we will represent our town anywhere we're going because the name of our town was in the front of the shirt. That's who you represent.
Yeah.
The name come in the back, and the front come the name of your town. So you take pride on it, so.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that. And folks, I should have mentioned, you know, Raya coached in Cuba, you know, so we're going to talk about that in a minute. And from Regla, Cuba, you know, it's real close to Havana right there. But let me ask you, let me jump because I probably should have started with this because it's a unique story and we'll come back to baseball. So you now at a certain age, at 26, you leave Cuba. Talk about those days, the days that you left Cuba, how you left, why you left, you know, the little bit of the journey, because it was a special time in history because, you know, you mentioned to me there was only a month that the Cuban government allowed this, obviously the U.S. government, but you talk about it because you know a lot better than I do.
Well, in the beginning of the 90s, it started crisis in Cuba. After the government stopped receiving help from the former Russia. And then, you know, there was a crisis in the country, in all areas. But in my personal level, I always was with the mindset of growing as a human being and traveling and knowing and reaching myself. So I found myself limited to accomplish my dreams, you know? So I had a bigger dreams than being just in my island, okay? I practically travel around the entire island of Cuba. I started when I was 13, 14, and I always want to get to know new places, new people, and I found limited in my country. And then when it came to baseball, you know, I started coaching in 1991, and I started coaching at all levels, starting at 9 years old to adults. You know, we got these tournaments that are organized in the Havana, and you know, there is 15 cities in Havana. So we play against each other in all age level, okay? But after that, the hopes of going farther than that were limited. And then I had the opportunity to play with a team from Venezuela. I also was invited to go to Venezuela to work over there, but there was some limitation from the government side. So looking into that, I was like, okay, no matter what I do, I always gonna have some kind of limitations. And, you know, looking ahead of the future, I knew that nothing better was coming in my way. So I started to looking for my own future in my own way. And so in the summer 1994, Cuban government decided to open the coast to all Cubans that wanted to leave the island and wanted to make the dream in the United States. You can go on your own, at your own risk. So that was only for a period of month. And then I jumped on a raft a couple of times because the first time I wasn't successful. So I had to return back. And
Maria, just for a second, you guys had a raft. You had to take it now from Havana to the U.S. These are not easy waters. You know, to just have a raft. Did you build the raft, or did somebody give it to you?
No, I built the raft with some friends. We use intertube. Go inside the turret. It's not typical in here, but it's normal in Havana. And we built it. After we were like 5 miles away from the shores, we started making water, and we got no other choice that come back. So we had to split time between the people on the raft. We divided, and we went swimming back. We made it to the shores. I decided to ride the next day, start building a stronger one. So I used a 55-gallon water tank, the metal ones, and I put it together, three on each side, made the floor, made some cones to break the wave, master. So the second time, yeah, I was fighting some big wave up to 6 feet high. And I was lucky that 30 miles away from Cuba, U.S. Coast Guard picked me up, and they took me to Guantanamo Bay, where I spent 14 months. It wasn't pretty at the beginning. It wasn't easy. It was kind of a survival situation. We made it, and that was what we cared about, you know?
Yeah, of course, and what perseverance, because, you know, and the risk that you're taking, but also tell the audience, you know, this wasn't just 10 people coming over. Now, it was legal because Cuba allowed you to leave, but there were a lot of people during this month, some people did not make it.
You're absolutely right. It is calculated that around 35,000 people more left Cuba about that time. And Guantanamo Bay was around 32,000 people in there, meaning that the rest of the people did not make. No only that they did not made it. There also there were some people that made it to Guantanamo, but they did not make it to the U.S. or they did not make it back to Cuba either. Because at the beginning, the situation was so challenging. We were getting like a cup of cereal in the morning, oatmeal in the morning. Mm. At night, they were giving rice only. So it was kind of a survival situation. And then some people were desperate and they were escaping from the camps. We were like in concentration camps and they were jumping into the water trying to get back to the Cuban territory. Wow. We were around 30 feet high of the sea level. So people jumping over, they were landing on the rocks. Those people that made it to the water, all of them made it back to the Cuban side swimming. Hmm. So, and I remember seeing the Coast Guard with the lights on and rescuing people. And next day, you see a lot of people with a lot of bandage in the head and the arms and the legs. Also, there is some people that were trying to cross the border and make it to the Cuban territory. But there was a lot of mines in the Cuban side because that's how they were protecting from the Americans coming into the side, the Nava base. So here and there at night, sometimes you hear a boom.
Wow.
That boom means that somebody stepped on a mine. Somebody lost their lives trying to make it back because they were desperate. Because the first thing they told us before we got off of the big ship was you would never travel to the US. Right? So some people were fine with that. As long as we were on the American territory with the American flag, we were fine. You know, smell some kind of freedom.
Yeah. Now, what do you think? Out of all those people in Guantanamo Bay, did most of them get back? Get eventually? It took you 14 months. Did most of them get a chance to go to the U.S.?
Well, most of the people did. On May 2nd, 1995, the two government, Cuban government, U.S. government, make an agreement of 20,000 visas to the U.S. And then they include us into those 20,000 visas. They gave priority to the seniors, 70 and over, and then family, kids. Mm. The reason that I spent 14 months is because I was in a camp where there was men only. So men were the last one to get out. So the last person to get out spent 18 months.
Wow.
The last person to get out spent 18 months. So the last flight was 18 months.
Were you allowed to exercise? You guys play some baseball. What did you do every day for 14 months?
Since day one, I was exercising since day one. You and the camp, yes, of course, we didn't have nothing in the first day. So push-ups, sit-ups, running. But then with the time, we started building our own gym. Since we got experience in building up that, when I was in college, I had to go to remote places in Cuba and built exercise campus for the kids to play, like a volleyball. So it's placing one stick over here, one stick over there on the other side, get a rope across and teach them to play volleyball. And using those skills that I learned in college, I did the same in Guantanamo. And then, you know, we had to kill the time instead of let time kill us, you know? So yeah. Yes, I exercise every day. And then we start talking to people in the army, the commanders in the army, and to allow us play softball and baseball. So after eight months, after May 2nd, 95, that's when they allow people get out of the camp and visit some of the camps. because we were concentrated in one camp only, and you could not get out of there. So when they did that, then we started organizing tournaments in this camp against the other camp. And so each camp, we have their own softball team, their own baseball team.
There were different camps in Guantanamo.
Oh, multiples, yes. Yes.
And
yes.
The equipment. What about the equipment? Did you make the equipment, or did you? Was it a stick and some clothes that you rolled up?
Well, we start getting buckets and a stick and concrete, make concrete, and let it dry, and then flip it over another bucket and lift those buckets concrete. Right. Yeah, like a weight. But with the time, then they built a gym for us. I was spending 3 hours in the morning in the gym, lunch, afternoon, I would play softball or baseball all afternoon, and at night, I will study a little bit of English.
Did the military give you bats and balls, or how did you play softball?
Yes. They start helping us with that. Actually, people in Miami were making donations and sending clothes and all those kind of things for us, including, there was a visit that they can take a family did, Tito Rojas, Rubén Sierra, René Arocha, a lot of Major League Baseball players. They came to the Guantanamo Bay and they made some donations.
Ah, nice.
And with those equipment, we start playing. We also, and there, got the opportunity to see Gloria Estefan came on her birthday. Remember Arturo Sandoval, Cuban, you know. So, yes, Willie Chirino came too. So a lot of people started supporting us in there and with the time. And that's how we started acquiring equipment and everything else, clothes. Because the first months, I was in my same clothes that I left Cuba for the whole month.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you about this part, because you're there 14 months. You're trying to stay busy mentally, to stay focused, you know, healthy. But at the same time, in the back of your mind, you don't know if you're going to make it to the U.S. It could be 14 months. And then they say, no, now you have to go back to Cuba.
Absolutely true, Peter. I got to witness people that were weighing 200 pounds, lost 80, 90 pounds without exercising, just mental.
Yeah.
Because they just thinking about when and when and when. And it is like the pandemic right now. You just got to take one day at a time.
Good point.
Because tomorrow, you don't know what's going to happen. The only thing you can control is today. What are you going to do today? So my mind was about this morning, I'm going to the gym. This afternoon, I'm going to play softball. Tonight, I'm going to study this, the book. I'm going to read this. I'm going to read that. Or I'm going to write a letter to my family. Yeah. Because I used to write 4 letters so I could get a chance that one of them would make it to my family. Get a chance that one going to make it to my family. Because wow. You know, I spent 11 months without seeing my sister. And she confessed to me when she came over that, you know, there was like a 4 months that I wasn't writing to them. And that's not true. I tell my sister, I was writing to you every single week. As a matter of fact, we all did, because we knew what was happening the other side. So they were collecting the letters that we were sending to the family, and they were burning those letters. So your family never got those letters.
Incredible. Go ahead.
So, I mean, it was a psychological word, but answering your question, even though that I was told that I never going to travel to the U.S., I was convinced that I never going to go back to Cuba. Yeah. So it's just looking forwards and don't look back, you know? I mean, there was some challenge for people, of course, because they have family that left kids out there, and then you are thinking about your kid, how they're doing, they need you. You were the main source of support for the family. So it wasn't different for everybody. So in my case, I was a single man, and you know, it was different. You know, I was determined that I want to come over here, that anywhere but going back to Cuba.
Yeah, and I like the, you know, I understand the comparison with the pandemic a little bit, because, you know, obviously what you went through in Guantanamo, waiting 14 months, that's incredible. But to compare it, like, with the pandemic, people are struggling. If they took it one day at a time, exercise, they did, you know, they stayed busy. They tried to figure out, you know, like myself, you know, I haven't worked in 12 months. So I try to figure out, you know, what can I do in the game of baseball that might be different? You have to reinvent yourself sometimes. So there's a lot of positives that come out of this. Now, the mental struggle, you know, to wait 14 months is incredible. When you now get the visa to come to the U.S., that has to be like winning the lottery. What was it like all of a sudden, now you get that chance to come to the U.S. and now you go to the U.S. because you don't know many people in the U.S.
The night before coming over here, that was the longest night of my life. Because there was 172 people that we go on a flight together. And that happens 3 times a week when we are getting up. So the night before, they take you to a camp with the only people that will fly next day go to that camp. So when you get to that camp, you cannot sleep. You cannot sleep. It's just, are we going? Are we making? But I'm going to tell you a funny story, okay? I came on October 17, 1995. About that time, there was a hurricane in Florida. And then we left the naval base in Guantanamo to the military base in Homestead, in the south of Florida. So the hurricane passed by. And when I am on the plane, and I start looking down, trees fall down, some buildings destroyed. I was like, are we really back to Cuba or are we going? So I was like, are we in Cuba or are we in the US? So we land in a military base. You know, I remember seeing the guy from the army taking out a backpack from the plane, all those kind of things. I was like, you know, I wasn't sure that I was in the U.S. because Homestead at that time did not look like the U.S. I was like, wow.
Now, first time flying, I guess not much money, hardly any clothes. You arrive. I mean, amazing. What did you think when you first arrived? You know, and you, how did you get work? How did you live here? Because that can't be easy. Did the U.S. government help in some ways?
Peter, when I came in, I remember having $15 in my pocket. And then a friend of my dad picked me up, and they took us to a hotel, okay, in Miami, where the family knew that that was the place where you will get people coming over from Guantanamo. So they will call your name, Peter Caliendo, your families are there. When they call my name, I don't knew who was picking me up. Now, those people that did not have family, they would be assigned to a state, Philadelphia, Oregon. Somebody will sponsor them, you know, a church, something like that. But then when I when they call my name, that I get out, I did not recognize anybody. So a friend of my dad, they knew that I was coming through my grandma, who I did not meet before. He waited until everybody left. And then he approached me. He said, are you Ernesto Raya? Yes, I am a friend of your dad. Your grandma sent me over here because my grandma was 85. So I met my grandma for the first time when I was 27, because
Wow.
she left Cuba in 67, 1967. I was born in 68. So he brought me to my grandma, who I was writing to from Guantanamo, and she was writing back to me. So I met my grandma, and then I used my grandma phone to call some friends. And I called some friends, and they started coming over and handing some money to me and offering me, you know, a room for a month and here and there. So I lived in Florida for 6 months. But definitely at that time, there was not many opportunity for us, because you had to think about all the people that were coming from Guantanamo, plus all the people that are coming from other countries. The language barrier, that you don't speak English, you know.
Now to let our folks know, folks, if you're on Facebook Live, I know you got some questions. I'm going to ask the questions in a little bit. I apologize. You can type them in the comments section. Very interesting story. You know, Raya, the other part of this is you're here in the U.S., and folks, so you know, Raya not only is coach, he's teaching grammar school, but he's coaching Matea Valley High School, the freshman sophomore baseball team. He's been coaching there, also with the Chicago White Sox Academy. Does a lot of things with the academy, the camps, you know, the facility and all that. Raya, what was your first job that you got? Was that in Florida? Because all of a sudden now you're in Chicago.
In Florida, I worked for 9 days out of 6 months in a factory. Unloading trucks with furnishes. And then I decided to come to Chicago because besides that, I have my family over here. I got an uncle and an aunt, and they came in the 1967, the same time that my grandma. And then my uncle got his own business. So I started working with him in, the same time I was going to a school, Triton College, to learn English. So I did that for a year and a half. And then I started working in my degree that I have from Cuba. So I transferred all my grades from Cuba to the US, which gave me a bachelor degree in physical education, recreation, and sports. That's what I did in Havana. I specialized in baseball. And then in 1999, I started working as a physical education teacher in a middle school. I still teaching today in Naperville. It's been 22 years as a teacher, as a mentor, as a coach. I also did a master in sport management in Northern Illinois University. And there I got the opportunity to go to during my internship to work with the White Sox and the baseball operations. And that's where I met Mike Huff. And since then I've been working with the White Sox Academy as a baseball instructor. We offer clinics to little leagues, teams, coaches. We do private lessons and we do summer camps too for all kids around all Chicago land. So I've been enjoying both sides, working with kids, baseball, mentoring, you know.
I got to ask you, because you and I talk about this, you know, I lived here. I grew up here. I was born in the U.S., went to Italy when I was 3 to live with my grandparents. Till I came back when I was 7, first language Italian. But I lived here all my life. And you come over at 27. You have to learn the language. You have no money. You have to get a job. You get a degree. You're teaching, you're coaching, you've done more, you know, in a shorter period of time than I've done my whole life here in the U.S. when it comes to education. So folks, don't tell me you can't do it, because there's a living proof. Somebody comes over here, doesn't even know the language, what he has accomplished just in teaching and in the game of baseball. But I do want to ask you, the first time you started coaching baseball here, or even teaching, What was the difference between the Cuban players and the American players? I mean, were you shocked about something? Was you know, you're wondering why we do things differently. Was there anything strange or different that you had to deal with?
Well, there was a lot of things that came to my mind. It was, first was, I wish I had this opportunity when I was growing up. I wish that I had the opportunity to play in fields like this one. I wish that I have the opportunity to travel and play, you know, because sometimes, you know, we say we want to go this place, we want to go to the other place, and we don't even know our neighborhood, you know? So we don't walk. We get on our cars and we drive, and we don't pay attention to our neighborhood, and we're trying to know new places. We want to go to Rome. We want to go to Italy. We're going to go to Dominican Republic, right? We want to go to all these places. We're going to go all over, right? And we don't pay attention to our neighborhood. And that's a different, you know, in Cuba, you walk everywhere and you get to know your neighborhood. When it comes to baseball, we do not take for granted one day, because we want to get better every day, because we want to play, not just be part of the team. We want to be on the field playing. We want to be a regular player every day. When I came over here and I see that some kids are just on a team or in a place just because they were a placer over there versus you earning that spot, it caught my attention. It shocked me a little bit because, you know, I know that there's a lot of kids that wish to have that opportunity, you know, that they have today, like a lot of kids that don't even have shoes to play baseball. They don't have their own glove, because that was us sometimes. We're going to share the glove. We're going to share the bat. We're going to share the baseball. And today, a lot of kids take that for granted. You know, they have it and they don't appreciate it. They leave it on the field. And that's a little different for me than the way I grew up. But
that's a great point, because you hear all the time that the reason Latin players come over is because they want to get away from the Dominican Republic. You know, it's the way off the island, or a way to play baseball in the U.S. But when you were young, kids were playing because they love the game and because they want to get better. They necessarily were not playing because they knew they're leaving Cuba. That wasn't like the Dominican Republic. Back then, you were just playing for the love of the game, and you played every day.
You play for the love of the game. You play for the love of the game. If you don't love the game, if you don't love what you're doing, don't do it. You're wasting your own time. You're lying to yourself. You cannot lie to yourself. If you're lying to yourself, what are you going to expect from everybody else? If you do not believe in yourself, who's going to believe you? If you don't see yourself in one place, who's going to see you there? So you have to have that vision, you know? Like, honestly, I was in Havana, and I was walking by the Malecón, the seawall, you know, like we have an Lakeshore Drive over here. Yeah. And I was picturing myself and the other side, the end of the horizon. I look at the lights. I was looking at the lights of the U.S. I'd be there someday. And that's how I got here. And I was picturing myself in Chicago. And that's how I got over here. And I pictured myself in baseball. And that's how I got into baseball. If you don't see yourself doing that, it won't happen. So, I mean, you have to believe in yourself. Also, my motto, living Cuba and all my life, has been, it is better to fail trying to succeed than never succeed because you were afraid to fail. Okay? And that's what I tried to teach my kids. Okay? If you don't try, you're never going to know. Okay? The only way to find out if you try. Okay? It's better to fail trying to succeed. Now, failure is just an opportunity to do it again in a smarter way. You know, we talk about baseball all the time, right? The game of failure, right? 70% of the time, and you're still great. You made millions. If you failed 70% of the time, you made millions in Major League Baseball because you are so good, right? So it's a game of failure. We talk about all that all the time, right? So it should be normal. It should be part. It should be part of the learning process, okay? So that's why my definition of failure is an opportunity to do it again in a smarter way, because you learn from the failure, okay? You know what you did wrong, right? You swung a high pitch. Okay, next time you see it coming, hold your bat. And if you apply that to everything in life, you're just gonna be improving every day, because yesterday you cannot change it. You know, the last pitch, you cannot change it. So
great message. Love the message. You know, the other part of all this is, as we go back, when you were coaching in Cuba, what did you guys stress? You know, because, you know, we have Bill Sandillo who asked a question about, you know, in Japan, they teach everybody the same way to pitch, same way to hit. Now the Cubans in hitting, I noticed their style. They used to teach, you know, the front knee, just cock it in and then go. It was just like a little knee cock and go. Yeah. But is that everybody taught the same way, or you allow kids to do their own thing?
Peter, there is a lot of players that they stand in a certain way naturally. And if they're successful, you just let them go like that, because you don't want to change something that is already working. Okay. So if it's working well, why do you want to change it? You know, we got the best player in the history of the baseball in Cuba, Omar Linares. And Omar Linares, the stance that he got, the way that he was holding the bat, it would never cross your mind that he could hit the ball or get the swing out of it. But it is just the stance. Doesn't matter how you stand. This is what you do when the pitch is coming. So he was standing with the bat like this, but when the pitch was coming, he was retrieving back, okay? So he was doing everything that he's supposed to do after that. And he's one of the best players ever. Now, what happened in Cuba is we don't have the technology. I mean, talking about my time, 80s, 90s, we don't have this technology. I don't even knew you when you were coming to play me.
Right.
No. So how do I gonna tell my players, oh, move to the right, move to the left? We made those assessments based on how fast the pitcher was pitching, you know, in what we saw you and the first at bat. So right in the game, but not before the game.
But I wanted to ask, because, and you said it perfectly, technology, because that was going to be my question. In Cuba, folks, what I was told, at least the 9 times I was there, that the medical and the school system, universities, very good. So how did you guys know how to teach the fundamentals, you know, to make the player better, fielding fundamentals, hitting? Did you just do it, or did you have some studying behind it?
We studied. When I was in college, we were studying Major League Baseball. We were getting, at that time, I went to college from 86 to 91. So we were studying a video cassette at that time from MLB. But we also have coaches that were able to play before 1959. They were able to play in the U.S. They played Double A, Triple A, and Major League too. I was fortunate enough to work with 5 of them. They were former professional players in the U.S. So the knowledge that they got, that's what they were passing into the next generation. Because when I was a little kid, those people that I got to work with, they were my coaches. And I remember them teaching me about the game and how they were playing the game over here in the 50s. So the fundamentals of the game have never changed. The fundamentals of the game are the same. What is changing is how you approach the game, the strategies that you use in the game. You bring this picture now, you bring, in my time, the starter pitching is pitching fine and is controlling the game. You let it complete the game. There was no pitcher count. So we don't know how many pitches. So we didn't have that in mind, you know? So it was a little different. Now, I tell you what, I remember pitchers retiring at the age of 30, 32, 33, okay? Because, of course, the use of their arm through the years, you know? Versus now, you see that they go a little longer because what? Well, the 100 pitches, you get it out, 90 pitches, you get it out, and you give it rest. It's different, but, you know, Cuba is doing that right now, too. I mean, they're more into, they're up to date with the baseball and here and there.
Part of the difference is, I would think, of course, they play games, they practice, but the major difference is they also play, like you said earlier, as a kid, you're just playing all day, even if you don't have practice. So is that what gives the Cuban players great instincts? Because they have great instincts for the game, base running, you know, anticipation of the game. You know, you could take a Cuban team at any level, in my opinion, let them just play and they'll play on their own with no problem. They don't have to have direction. Where does that come from? Working in practice a lot?
Okay, I'm going to talk for myself because I haven't been in Cuba since I left. And then I don't want to give a wrong message to anyone. But I remember, okay, that I would get a tennis ball and I would throw the tennis ball against the wall of my house 100, 200 times a day. And then I would play you. If you drop it, it would count as a run for me.
Yeah.
If you got to catch it three times, you got to get 3 outs in order to switch and you throw the ball against the wall and then I will play defense. So it was a pastime that you would do in front of your house. At the same time, you are working eye-hands coordination, forehand, backhand, catch. You're doing all that right there. Right? So today you go to practice your team and what you do? You got partnered up and you got then rolling the ball to each other and bouncing the ball one bounce. And those are drills. We naturally did it without knowing, but it was part of our pastime. When we play, you were talking about New Zealand 5-on-5 game, right? I was listening last night to that show. And it caught my attention that it's official game in this country now, 5-on-5, right? We play those games in the street with the tennis ball and hit it with the hands all day long. We get the trash can and we put it in the corner of the street. We block the street, make it look like it was a block party. So the cars cannot pass by and we play baseball all day. That was our pastime on Saturday and Sunday. We only have one baseball field, so we cannot use the town baseball field to play pickup games. Those are for official games only. So we had to play in the street. We had to play over the gravels. So that was part of growing up, naturally, you know, that's a pastime. There was not much to do. And then you only need a tennis ball. You don't need equipment. You mentioned a few minutes ago about soccer becoming bigger. Soccer is the most popular game in the world, but also it's the cheapest game in the world.
Yep.
You just need a soccer ball. You put 2 stones in one corner, 2 stones in the other one, you got 2 goals. And that's how we used to play too as a child. So that's the reason too, because you have to look at it. No, everybody got a glove in Cuba. No, everybody got a bat. There's no baseball, not even for the coaches to train their team. So,
Raya, this is great stuff. I want to talk about practice in a minute in Cuba. When you were a kid and when you coached, so your experience in practice. But also, I want to mention to the folks, you know, I'm sitting in Havana when we took our team to Reglas, and I was sitting with some coaches talking about practicing, you know, organizing, and they stopped me. This was my first time there. They stopped me and said, Pete, we love a lot of things you're telling us. There's only one little problem. We only have 5 baseballs, or we only have 2 baseballs for practice. Talk about that and how you were able to run practices, whether your coach or whether when you were coaching in Cuba, how you were running practices with 2-3 baseballs?
Well, in those days where you have only 2 baseballs, you will have to do a game, scrimmage game, and you will teach over the game. You teach the kid. But there was not any other thing that you could do because there was only 2 balls. A rainy day. When you got rainy days and there was mud, you will have to modify the game, and because those balls will get bad and you will lose it. Now, when you lose the skin of the ball, the other thing that we used to do, that I know people that still doing it. I have coach, a friend of mine that they coach in Colombia. They get that ball and they put it in glue. Mm. They let it dry.
Glue.
Yes. You let it dry, and then you reuse it. And then you use it for soft toss, for ground balls, because this team that I have the opportunity to work with them like 2-3 years ago, Colombian team, in here, they infill is made of gravel. And I am familiar with that because in 1991, when I started coaching in Cuba, I got 5 different teams, 9-12, 13-14, so on. That was how we were practicing. Practically, sometimes was over the gravel. Mm. He helped you with the reaction and, you know, eye hands coordination. But when we're talking about balls, you need balls to practice. If you don't have balls, you can practice. So, yes, it's a challenge. It's a challenge on the daily basis.
As a Cuban coach, when you were there and you had enough baseballs, what were some of the, okay, we all want to work on fundamentals. We all want to work on hitting. We work on pitching and skills and all that. But what else did you work with the young kids that prepared them more for a game? Because we can practice a lot, but if we don't practice for the real thing, sometimes it's difficult that it transfers into the game. So what did you guys do?
Well, the first thing you do when you have enough ball to do a practice, the first thing that comes to your mind is BP. Because you don't have balls every day to practice BP. So today we're going to do BPs. And you guys going to go to your position. You're going to catch those balls that the hitter hit to you. Okay? And that's how you're going to practice ground balls and fly balls.
Yeah.
Real. We also divided. And then we have kids working in soft toss. We didn't have tees. We don't have tees to practice.
Right.
Okay. And what we used was in order to work on the swing, like you're working on a tee, hitting the ball in a specific spot, we would use the tire of a car. We would get a metal tube and stick that tire on the ground and then paint where we want the kids hit with the bat.
Mm.
Like that's the height of the pitch. That's the level of swing that we want you to have. So we paint that tire where we want those kids hit the ball. Like that was the tee, but no balls.
Yeah.
So you get to practice the swing. You're going to hit the white spot. We paint it white. It was a black tire. So we paint it white. You're going to hit that white spot. And then you hit it like 100 times. And that was a tee for practice. So soft toss, yes, we do infield drills, outfield drills. We practice the fundamental, throwing to the bases, throwing to second, throwing to third, throwing to home, all those kind of in the situations of the game. We teach the kids communication skill, assistance, very important in the game. That sometimes you see here in little kids and little leagues that not even little leagues, I'm talking about 14, 15 years old, that they don't know where they're supposed to go when the ball's going this way in the outfield. So, yeah, that's different than here.
When you were playing games, How did you work with the players during the game? Did you allow them to play more, make some mistakes, learn from the mistakes? What did a game look like when you were coaching?
Okay, so there is things in the game that you control. Like offensively, when you want to steal bases, running the bases, or you know, using the running the base to score, bouncing the ball, and all those kinds of things, is the only time you control the game. You can tell the kids where they're supposed to be positioning. Okay, move a little bit to the right, move to the left, according to how the pitcher was throwing the ball, how fast he was throwing. But you don't have control of what they do in the field, right? So I always tell my kids, listen, the only one who won't make an error in the game is me. And you guys want to know why? Because I'm not playing. Because if I were playing, I might drop a ground ball or I might throw in the bench. So relax. It is okay. Just prepare yourself for the next one, okay? So don't worry about it. Because it is expected. If you play any game that you play, you're going to make an error, okay? We are humans, right? So no matter it's basketball, you're going to miss a shot. Look at Michael Jordan. How many times? People just count how many points he scored. 32 points, 40 points. People never count how many times he missed.
Right?
And he missed more than he made, right? So on my kids, I always, anything, any play, I always tell, listen, the only one won't make an error on the field is me because I'm not playing. So I expect that all of you are going to make an error, okay? I don't want you to do it, but if you do it, get back up and, you know, fix the next one. Pick up your teammate, okay? If he dropped the ball, okay, make sure that you back it up with an amazing play and, you know, get it out that we need. You are pitching, make sure you strike out on this batter and don't let it count, okay? If we come at bat and then you pick up your friend with the bat, okay? Your teammate, okay? That's how we lift people up, okay? Each other, because we all gonna make an error on the field. So for me, making error on the field is part of the game, you know? Everybody
does this. What else helped you when you were in Cuba? What helped you become a better player and a better coach? What things did you take from Cuba when you were there and bring them to the U.S. to work with your players now?
I would give credit to all the coaches that I had. I would give credit to the mentors that I have when I was in college. You know, one of them, Pedro Medina.
Mm-hmm. Pedro.
Yes. When I graduated from college, I got so much knowledge on me that I say, I wish I knew all this growing up. I would be in big leagues now if I knew all this, how the game, all what I know about the game today. If I knew 10 years ago, I would be a better player, you know. But my coaches, you know, they inspired me a lot because they were more about the character of the human being that you become through the game, okay? And that give you some respect as a coach, okay? When you get to know someone, when you get close to someone, and you talk to them and you get to understand them, then you know better how to help them, okay? It's like a teaching, you know, the kids. You don't know why the kids is misbehaving, but when you know why the kids is misbehaving, you know how to approach that kid. You understand that kid, and then your approach change. And coaching is the same thing. You gotta know your players, for example. Let's say one player come to me and say, Mr. Raya, I did not sleep enough last night. I wasn't feeling good. Or my sister got sick. I got to go with my mom to the hospital. We spend the night in the hospital. So what do you expect from that player in the game? You know, it's tired. It doesn't get enough sleep, right? Yeah. You're going to expect that much. So now you understand. So now maybe you say, well, I might get 3 or 4 innings out of him, right? Even if it's a pitcher, he's a player, okay? But if it's, you know, if you are playing unknown at 95 degrees, you have to consider everything. There's a lot of factors in the game that the people sitting in the stands don't know, you know? And then when your head is not in the game, that's another factor, you know? You are not thinking about what the pitcher is throwing, how he's releasing the ball. You're thinking of, you know, what happened to you yesterday. So there's a lot of factors in the game that as a coach, you know, sometimes we are watching game on TV and we say, oh, how come he did that? How come he did it? And we are questioning over here, bro. He know what he's doing because he talked to that player. He was in the clubhouse and, you know, he got the information that you don't have, you know? And talking about that in Cuba and here, let's say, for example, we got so much information today. Oh, Peter can hit 280 against righties, and then he's 240 against lefty. Okay, we didn't have that. We didn't have that. We just go by, okay, he's a lefty hitter. Let's bring a lefty, right? But we don't know you hit 280 or 320 with the lefty, you know? So we don't have that information as a coach in Cuba, you know? I don't even think it says today. They don't have that technology in the game today. Did they use it for training? Maybe at the national team level, they do, but not on the college level, not on the high school level. I remember seeing the first time that I faced a machine and batting practice was in college.
Yeah.
And I only got to face it once. I didn't got to see it again. It was one day that we went to the University of Havana to play against them, and we practiced before the game. And it was only one time. So we don't have those resources. And the game changed a lot from country to country because the resources that people use for the game. But
I talk to our coaches in the U.S. and around the world. I know we're trying to get some phone calls in, but we're only taking messages on Facebook questions. No phone calls. Sorry, folks. Talk to coaches, players, and parents in the U.S. because now you've spent a lot of time in the U.S. Coming over from Cuba. Talk to them about some things they do very well here, but also some things they need to change. Culture, mentality, training. If they don't change, things can get worse.
Okay. To the parents out there listening to me right now, I've been teaching for 22 years, and I also been working in baseball. And I will tell you this. 40% of the kids in America drop sports because parents pressure. Okay, you want to coach your kid, coach it outside the field. When they are in the field, let them enjoy the game. If they do not enjoy the game, they're going to leave the game. Okay, it is very simple. They don't like it, they won't do it. They might like the game, but they might not like to deal with the pressure that you're putting on them in the game. For example, most of the time, parents over here are talking about the good things they do. They provide the opportunity to the kids to play the game at different levels. Other than Little League, they place it in travel team. Travel team offers the opportunity to face some quality players, but doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to face more quality players all the time. And then when they are doing travels, they schedule 40 games in 2 months, and they spend 3 hours in the road and sleep over in the hotel, get up early in the morning, go out, play doubleheader, go again, and then the kids are exhausted. They are not getting better at the game. They don't get better at the game during the game. They get better at the game outside the game where they got the opportunity to practice those skills. That's when you got the opportunity to coach the kid. When they are in the game, just let them play the game, okay? That's not a moment to teach. That's not a moment to tell them what to do And then when the parents started screaming and yelling from the crowd, the kid is not focused, not concentrated on the picture and the game. They're just thinking about what the dad say in the crowd, and don't throw like this, and don't swing like that, and stay like this, move your arm back. So much information and stress that don't let the kid enjoy the game. Let the kid enjoy the game. Let him be a kid. I mean, Michael Hogg mentioned it to you, but that's my philosophy too for a long, long time ago. From the moment they start playing baseball, 6, 7, 4, 5, t-ball to 12, let them enjoy the game. Don't get serious about the game, okay? Because if you think your kid gonna play Major League Baseball because he played baseball from 6 to 12, wow, there were a lot of people Major League Baseball now, yeah. Right? So let him enjoy the game. And then by the age of 12, he decides to continue playing the game because he loved the game. And then it's when you start getting a little more serious about the game. And then you can provide some private lessons. And you can provide, you know, some different kind of training that you might want to. But to the moment, let him enjoy the game. Do not get serious until he passed 12, because maybe by middle school, he might change his mind. My son played baseball when he was 7, 8. And then he told me, I don't want to play baseball anymore. Okay, my son, what do you want to play? Then he decided to play soccer. Played soccer 2 years. And then he did karate for 4 years. Now he's a senior high school. He's playing football the last 4 years. And that's what he wanted to do, football. So you got to, you know, provide support what your son wants to play or your daughter. Okay? Let him enjoy the game. So that's the only thing, the message that I would like to send to the parents. When you are in the game, enjoy it. And if you see something that you would like to do, okay, wait until you get in the car and drive home and talk to, or after, let him eat. He might be hungry. He might not be listening to you. Let him eat first and then talk about it, or tomorrow talk about it, you know?
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a great message to the parents. Folks, if you join us on Facebook, thanks for joining us. By the way, we are with Ernesto Raya, called Raya. That's what we call him, is Raya from Reglas, Havana. Listen, folks, he came over at 26 years old, but he didn't just come over, you know, on a flight, and an easy flight, you know, in first class. He came over in a raft, was picked up by U.S. Coast Guard, 14 months in Guantanamo Bay. So he didn't come right to the U.S., no money, nothing, knew a few people in U.S. The rest is history when he got here. He's done a great job. He's doing a great job in baseball. You know, Raya, the other part I want to ask you is the coaches, because it sounds like your message to the coach a little bit was also, I believe, sometimes we're not practicing enough. We want to play a lot of games now, right? We're 11 years old, 10 years old, we want to play 50, 60, 70 games. But, you know, sometimes we forget in the summer when you're playing that if you don't practice, how are you going to get any better?
Well, nobody gets better if he doesn't practice. You got to practice. It's a matter of managing time to practice versus 80 games. You spend more time when you are in those travel teams over here, they do 40 games in a period of 2 months, okay? You are spending more time the road that you spend in playing the game, learning about the game, or getting better about the game. So that's different. That you playing doesn't mean that you're getting better. That you are driving in the road, what it means is you're getting exhausted. You wake up at 4 a.m. because tomorrow you got a game in Indiana, okay? And then you expect your kid double herder and you expect him to perform, okay? You know, at top level, okay? You are providing opportunity to play the game, not to get better at the game because he's playing the game. You know, you practice outside the game and then you do it in the game. Because in the game, yeah, you learn, you are exposed, you got to practice, but let's say, okay, then you are playing shortstop, right? There's a big chance that you get 4 or 5 ground balls in the game, right? And that position, right? But if you're playing right field, how many fly balls are you gonna get? Maybe two or three, right? So how much better you can get with two or three fly balls?
Yeah.
Think about that, you know? And you are in the shortstop, you get five, four ground balls, that won't get you a gold glove. Lindor from the Clevelands, he used to get 600 ground ball from his dad, right? So that's how he got gold glove, you know, exposing. You know, that's when you learn in the practice. And, you know, what do you did wrong? Why you need to change the backhand, the forehand, the approach, the step, where are going to release the ball? All those kinds of things you learn in practice. And you practice and practice. It becomes a habit. You don't even think about it, you know. So that's how it is.
You know, speaking about the infield part, what's your advice with coaches nowadays with young kids? You know, we're looking at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. You know, when I grew up, it was work a lot on fielding balls right at you. We didn't work a lot on backhand, forehand, or throwing from different angles, or, you know, different plays that you're going to make. What's your advice when they're young? Just let them be athletic and just do different things?
Okay, to improve your eye-hands coordination, okay, you not necessarily have to get ground balls, okay? I will tell you what I did when I was 14, 15. I played ping pong every day. Eye-hands coordination is the ability to place your hands without looking at it, right? To place your hands where the ball is without looking at it. So when you're playing ping pong, you see it coming. But when you make contact with the racket, you don't see it. You just place your hands in there, right?
Yep.
If you play air hockey on the table, you are doing the same thing. You are placing the hands where the puck is coming, okay? And your eyes are moving and your hands are going to the place where the puck is coming. That is fun for the kid. You don't even have to tell them that you are doing, that you are practicing that, right? I got a young son too. And that's what we do in the basement. We play air hockey, but that's what I'm working on. He doesn't know,
yeah,
but I'm doing it. And then that could be a family outing and yeah, you go and play, have fun, and you got your kid practicing. And then the other thing that I did was throwing the ball. And some people have a ping pong table in the basement. Play ping pong with your kids. You are spending quality time with your kid and you are developing eye-hands coordination, you know, and you know how to be in the kid. And then your kid, when the balls come, they're going to do it naturally because he's been practicing the whole time.
You know, folks, you know, we talk about this a lot on the show and you think about it. When you come in from Cuba, Dominican Republic, you know, you're playing with different baseballs, different size bats. You know, you're not worried about how many feet the pitching mound is, how many feet the bases are. You know, we now want, in the U.S., Ryan, now a big thing is training uncomfortable, meaning different weights on baseballs, different bat sizes, right? The different mounds, because that way you know how to adjust. But you guys have been doing that for years, not even knowing it. And that's, in my opinion, that's a big advantage that you have, why Cuban players or Latin American players are very good at what they do. I think just, you know, having different things like that, that make them feel uncomfortable. All of a sudden they come to the U.S. and now they get on a field. How about the field? Now I get it to play in a field where the grass is perfect. Well, this is easy, right?
Exactly. I remembered there was one or two bats for the whole team. Okay, when you think about that, let's talk about 9, 10 years old kids, right? So you have a bat that is 32 ounce or 30 ounce for the 9 years old. Well, that's what we have. Not all the kids are the same size. Not all the kids got the same strength, but everybody gonna be using the same bat. And you wondering why not all of them hit the ball the same way. Well, because he doesn't have the strength to get the bat on time, get it out on time, get his hand in front, because the bat is too heavy for him. But that's all what we got. And you don't think about it, and you don't see it like that, but you say, well, this kid, no, It's not that good. He cannot even get the bat on time up there when the pitch comes. Of course, the bat is too heavy for him, you know, but that's what we got. There's nothing else we could do.
They figure out. I mean, there's ways to choke up on the bat, make it lighter.
You grab his shoulder. Yep.
Yeah.
Raya,
I want to finish it with this because you've been great. We've been on a long time. I know you've got to get up tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the morning because you guys start practice. You finished 2 o'clock from school. You got on the show right away. I really appreciate it. Finish it with, you know, we talk about Cuban baseball. People are very interested in Cuban baseball. What did we not talk about Cuban baseball that was important to talk about? Mention something to our listeners that they can learn from Cuban baseball.
It is, if you look at what the baseball players in Cuba have been going through in order to get here and being successful, because I will tell you that not even players from the national team had it easier to make it to the national team, and not even to... I am a friend with Rene Arocha that was one of the first ones to come up over in 1992. And he was sharing on Facebook recently, he was sharing about how do they practice in Mexico with the national Cuban team before they were going to any official tournament, right? And the conditions that they were exposed, everybody was eye open because everybody's assuming that because they are in the Cuban national team, they got all the conditions created for them to practice, to play. And that is not the case. Any obstacles out there, okay, there is always a way to overcome them, okay? The only thing can stop you between you and your goal is yourself, okay? I place to my team in Google Classroom yesterday. We had a meeting regarding practice tomorrow, okay? We start practice tomorrow at 5:30 in the morning. You know how cold is it here in Chicago, okay? So I'm getting up at 4 in the morning, leaving the house at 4:30 to be in Naperville and practice at 5:30 in the morning, okay? I sent to them the link of the high school Japanese team practicing over the snow.
Yep, I saw
and
that.
I told them that I look forward to challenge ourselves this season, okay? Because we all talking about the pandemic, all the challenges that we've been through. Okay, all those challenges they've been through, the only thing they have done is make you stronger because you aren't here today. If you aren't here today, it's because you overcome all that already, okay? All that is behind you. So you know now that you can go forward, okay? And overcome anything your way. So I sent the link with the snow. I told them, I look forward to challenge itself because I cannot wait until to play baseball with the snow. I don't want to use the snow as an excuse that we cannot do this, we cannot do that, because the reason that we are practicing at 5:30 in the morning is because it's so many sports now, they are taking place at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the space is limited in the gym, okay? So we had to share with the volleyball team, softball team, basketball team. So we had to share the gym with all that, right? So if we can now use the gym, we're gonna learn how to play baseball over the snow. But I like that video a lot. I got a lot of respect for Japanese people because for me, they are self-discipline, respect, and love of the game. That's what Japanese baseball means to me, you know?
I love the end on that, and I'll tell you why, because I love the video that you sent. And, you know, like anything else, people who succeed, they don't, you know, they look at obstacles and they just go right through those obstacles. The Japanese don't make excuses. They just figure a way to get it done. Raya, this has been a fantastic show. I told you off the air that this may be one of the best shows I've ever done because it involves your struggles, your history of coming to the U.S., but also your coaching experience, playing experience in Cuba, bringing it here to the U.S. with the kids here. And I don't think there's any better story right now than that, what I just heard. I think that was some great stuff. We could probably go on for 10 hours, but I can't thank you enough. You know what? I'll let you, final message to our coaches, players in the U.S., final advice, if you want to give any, and we'll close off the show.
Peter, first of all, I want to say thanks to you for giving me the opportunity to speak to all your followers. And also, I want to invite all of people listening right now. This is a free opportunity for you to get better as a coach, listening to so many people that have been implementing the game of baseball in different part of the world. With less resources than we have over here. And then I think that's the small advantage that I have, because the way I grew up and the limited resources that I have to do the game, I still using those resources that I learned growing up and as a coach in Cuba, and also you saw it in the baseball convention, the World Baseball Convention for Coaches, how some of the training were centered on limited space, how to do drills on limited space, you know, and all those kinds of things that we could do today with what we have. So don't let anything out there to stop you to do what you need to do or what you love to do. You know, it is a great resource over here for free in the comfort of your house. Listen to your podcast, follow on YouTube, and you're going to meet a lot of amazing coaches, and you're going to learn a lot for free. So, you know, that's going to be my advice for the coaches out there.
Love it. And coaches out there, I take this show, let your players take a look at it. I mean, let them listen to this, man. What a story. Talk about adversity. You know, sometimes, and to our folks in the U.S., and especially in the U.S., sometimes I think when we have too much technology or too much information, you know, we depend on that information. I'm wondering if maybe we need to step back a little bit and play the game, practice, let them play the game on their own, practice, make it fun. You know, I get the technology part. I think it's good for coaches to use, but I think sometimes we enable players too much with all this technology and you know, the best glove, the best bat, the best this, the best that. I'm sure it helps a little bit, but man, listen to what we just talked about from Cuban baseball. This has been a great story. Hey, Raya, thanks, man. I love it. And I look forward to, we're in Chicago. I look forward to getting together, have some coffee, talking baseball.
You're Peter, thank you so much. I definitely look forward to that day.
All right, folks, Ernesto Raya. Listen, if you didn't get something out of this, you either weren't listening or you didn't write anything down, because I took a lot of notes. I thought it was fantastic. I want to thank Ernesto Raya for being on the show. How about it? Think about it. 14 months in Guantanamo Bay, comes over on a raft. The Coast Guard picks him up, you know, along with others. You know, they spend 14 months in Guantanamo, no money, same clothes. All of a sudden get a chance, and they're not sure they're going to get to the U.S. Remember, because it was a visa process. There were 20,000 visas at that time, but there were 32,000 people, a lot of people. You know, all of a sudden comes to the U.S. What a successful story. And I hope my folks in other podcasts pick this up and want to do another show with Ernesto, because I think MLB should do one, MLB Network. I think others should jump on this, especially the media in Chicago. Pick this up. Great story. People need to hear about it. Thank you to everybody in the U.S. and around the world for listening. Thanks to our broadcast, that is the Lineup Media Group's Brian Crock, our producer. Thank you. And don't forget, folks, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com. Hit the subscribe button. It really helps us out. YouTube, Peter Caliendo, subscribe there and encourage people to subscribe. We really appreciate it. Remember, stay healthy, be safe. God bless you. We'll see you on the next show, everybody. I'm Pete Caliendo. I'm your host. Can't wait to get to the next show. Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.